This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
I made this just for you.
No, Liz,
this is the title of the anthology I have. A collection of short stories by Chris Ames. And basically, they may or may not leave you just a little hollowed out when you look at some of the contemporary scenarios he's depicting. So, Chris, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we can only touch on a few stories. We won't get through to them all. But I was left with the suggestion of how our society seems today to be full of futility. Would that be a sort of summation of the overall feeling and impression?
Yeah, that's the vibe, but I think even with that key theme, there's a lot of humor and experimentation to add some levity to that futility.
Well, speaking of levity to the futility, the gesture. Let's start on the gesture. And basically, the gesture takes 3 seconds to exact. What is happening in the gesture and what is the significance?
A lot of my stories kind of start off as silly what-if questions. So even though it's slightly dated, there was a time when the GIF was sort of the predominant emotional expression on the internet. So I had this idea of what if it was someone's job to sort of enact GIFs for a living to commodify this human expression. And then trying to set a world in which that is believable and plausible and there are real stakes.
But this is actually happening. This is what frightens me.
Yeah, I mean, the more generous reading of that is like, well, an actor is someone whose job it is to perform a type of emotion on repeat, and that is something that we appreciate. And then maybe a less generous version would be, that your identity can be reduced down to this small 3-second clip that, you know, you have to perform for other people, or even the way that the algorithm has made plastic surgery and the sort of commodification of lots of people to have literally the same types of faces and emotions.
Yeah, well, our society is sort of generating that need or desire or way of looking at things. It's not expansive, it's reductive in how we go about life. But then what happens here? He has this gesture. He makes a fortune. And
yeah.
Then it disappears.
Yeah. I think, you know, I'm someone who's, I work in what is sometimes called knowledge work. I have a computer job. And I've always been fascinated with this idea of sort of intangible value and what it means for your real kind of flesh and blood life to be supported by something that is ultimately invisible or liminal or
vacuous. I'd call it vacuous, but I'm an old chalk encrusted teacher who was born before the age of the internet, computers, and everything digital. And I see it as vacuous in many ways.
I'm right there with you. I'm chalked up on the inside. Yeah.
So, and yet, basically, then he gets superseded by the next little 3-second moment or gesture.
Yeah. I mean, I think even outside of that story, a theme across the collection is the idea of identity as performance and people sort of being reduced to some sort of thing that they need to perform for others. And also, if you don't like that, your identity is something that can be dropped or sold or replaced with something else.
But what does that say about the substance? I mean, I come from a profession, education, where, you know, we've been teaching long-term values, the importance of literature, books, and yet it's again, being reduced to almost nothing.
Yeah, I think that's the question. It's something that I'm curious about. As a writer, in my day job, I do like brand strategy and you know, make websites for people. And a lot of times, there's this desire to, can you condense everything we stand for down to one sentence? And there's a real art to that, but there's also a lot gets lost in that reduction. Yeah.
But here we go. You're also playing with form in a lot of these stories. A time machine called grief. It's actually all one sentence. Have I got that right?
Yeah. I like many people who studied writing or just love reading, I stumbled upon Jamaica Kincaid's short story Girl, which is told in one kind of breathless sentence. And ever since reading that, was always really inspired to want to try that as a formal experiment. And in terms of wanting to capture like a sense of propulsion or breathlessness, tried to think about the times in my life in which that was the case. And the two kind of contrary things are the sort of ecstasy of like a night out and having fun, and the sort of despair of feeling captured by grief, and the weirdness of those two things together within the form of sort of one run-on sentence.
But you use the word ecstasy here because this story is about a drug.
Yes. I think, we follow this character who's just returned from bereavement leave, and their coworkers, in an effort to sort of lift their spirits, have scored them some drugs, which are called Time Machine, which is sort of abbreviated like TM, like a trademark. Yeah. And they keep taking these pills to sort of escape the trauma that they're in. And even though they're sort of being launched back to the past, this through line of trauma kind of worms its way into their brain.
And it's still constant. But here we go. By way of contrast, we've got one called Character Limit, which is actually a series of single sentences. Now, Lisa's going to identify with this. When was your last audition, Lisa?
I can't even remember. It's just too long ago.
Here we go. Let's see if this rings a bell. The audition call was intentionally vague. The most important thing is that you are your authentic self, it read. There were hundreds of men in the waiting room. One sentence. But again, that notion of we want something authentic, but it's got to be the same.
Yeah, the inspiration for the story came from, all these vocal assistants in our life, realizing that there were all these like perky female voices and like the sort of inherent misogyny that these male technical developers put into these voices. And I thought, it'd be interesting if there was a male voice, and what would that audition process look like? And in trying to wrote it as a more traditional story. But when I got to the scene in which the people were reading the cue cards of one line off of these cue cards, I thought, it'd be interesting if the story itself was in the form of one-liners. So every time the sentence sort of reached the width of my browser, forced myself to complete the thought, and could it take place in this sort of staccato audition style to match the theme of the story?
Just to diverge, are you saying, thank you for shopping at Coles, is as malevolent as I really think it is?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's an insight in the story, which is like, people will sort of take helpful advice from a female voice, but they'll only take direction from a male voice. So the way in which this tech is supposed to be this like neutral force for good in our life, but of course the inherent misogyny and racism gets baked into the things that these people are making.
This is getting serious. Well, not seriously depressing, but there's this undercurrent that keeps permeating through here. I made this just for you. June and Jacob do life together as a function. What's happened in their life?
Yeah, this is a story that sort of puts two kind of counter things together, which I think is a thing that my brain enjoys. In one, you're sort of following the very domestic life of a couple that has broken up, that has decided to stay together and co-parent and raise their new baby together.
But it raises the question of just how we live our lives, and really is all of the romance and the sort of extravagance of that initial meeting. Mm. But no, life is an extended thing that you've got to prepare for rather than that moment of frisson.
100%. Yeah, and then the sort of boring domesticity of that co-parenting is butted up against the weirdness of his job, which is that he sort of impersonates adult film actresses and chats on their behalf in order to get their fans to tip to see illicit content and sort of skim money off of that weird gig economy between creators and fans.
Yeah, and again, is that what is becoming of today's society?
This is a real business that exists. Yes. And I think that weird in-between layer of like identity as performance, sort of digital anxiety and digital longing, the weirdness of actually the best people to fulfill men's unrealistic expectation of women is other men pretending to be women. A lot of the themes and humor that I sort of like.
But then that crosses over in terms of the expectation we have of marriage and the reality of marriage and the longevity and things like that that you juxtapose there as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm a father of two young kids, and especially that newborn phase is so raw and animal, and it puts you in such a weird place. And I think the idea of, in one hand, you sort of have this, like, hot pink thing on your chest that you have a very specific type of love for, and then in his other hand, he's sort of typing, simulating this pseudo-heat and sort of getting these lonely men to pay for a version of love that they think they need.
Well, speaking of little children, this gets us to Switzerland. Now, I was able to identify with this and that the pathos here of a man on a plane having to nurse somebody else's child who's run off to the toilet, and it sort of causes him to evaluate life, where he's going, all the echoes, even though he has only a momentary responsibility for this child.
Yeah, a lot of my stories are trying to find, like, the weirdest way into just a boring human truth. So when you have a kid, there's that moment in the hospital where they hand you this thing and then they walk away and you're like, oh, this is, no one's going to help me. And that feeling of sort of being thrust into fatherhood, I wanted to explore with the idea of someone's on a long-haul flight. They're sort of like a man-child who's never really grown up. The person next to them is sick and thrusts their child into his arms. And in doing so, he's sort of thrust into this weird pseudo-fatherhood that takes place only for the duration of flight.
The flight. And but he's not sure where he's going, Switzerland or Japan.
Yeah. I'm also a huge fan of Miranda July, and she has the story Roy Spivey. Yeah. Which is set on a plane, and ever since reading that and also hearing it as read by David Sedaris, I really wanted to write a plane story. And this, the idea of, I don't know, you're so emotional and in this weird, you know, tin can in the sky, and I think the idea that you would have some sort of life-changing epiphany that ultimately only lasted for the duration of the flight. So he is able to access this false version of fatherhood, but ultimately is like a fleeting form of connection that he has to give the child back when she comes out of the bathroom.
Now, I seriously get out of my depth when these last two stories, 9-letter word for woman I'm in love with. How does this appear on the page, and what are you doing?
My lockdown activity was drinking Negronis and just doing crosswords with my wife. So I've always loved crossword as a form, and they have their own weird logic and humor to them. And for the longest time, I just had this idea of, what if the clues, instead of just being these independent little fragments, actually told a coherent story? So this story actually takes place as like a working functional crossword, where down is a character, across is a character, and they are sort of talking to one another and trying to flesh that out of being like, maybe by their nature, they are sort of diametrically opposed. They're having an argument. They're never, you know, really going to be able to meet or see things in the same way. So it's kind of like this bizarre, cryptic breakup story that takes place in the form of a crossword.
Now, I'm hopeless at cryptics. Do they are actual cryptic clues that work?
Yes.
This is where it gets beyond me. But also, we get seriously abstract. Everything solid is vibrating in place. A basement for 100 Chris's.
Yeah. So I guess back to that theme of like weird ways into normal truths. We follow a family, and the main concern is like, one, wanting to future-proof your family against disaster, and two, wanting to learn mistakes against the past. So he fills the basement with 100 replacements of himself, and she trains a chatbot on the data of her late mother so she can do the opposite of whatever the chatbot says. So you have one parent sort of safeguarding against the future and one against the past as a bizarre way to sort of, yeah, look after
genius.
Your children.
If you want genius. Surreal stories, if you want challenging in terms of form and content, the anthology, I Made This Just For You, the author Chris Ames, and it's released by Ultimo Press. So, Chris, thank you for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
So now, I mean, first of all, this sounds amazing, and I'm definitely grabbing that book on the way out. And so I'd like to introduce my guest for today. Her name is Anne Freeman, and she is the author of Returning to Adelaide and Me That You See. She was, in fact, in here for Me That You See, weren't you, Anne? Her latest novel, The Time After Now, is a contemporary story exploring love, regret, friendship, and the lasting impact of choices we make when we're young. Welcome, Anne.
Thanks, Lisa. It's so lovely to be here.
Oh, thank you. So The Time After Now is set in two timelines. It's centred around the protagonist, Liv. Can you tell us about these two timelines, please?
So the present timeline is suburbia of now, and the past timeline is 20 years ago. It's the post-millennium Melbourne underground rave scene.
Yes, and what a scene. It's thrilling. And so nice to go back there. I mean, the rave scene and Liv's younger life is incredibly vivid. What was it like revisiting the world of warehouse parties, drugs, art, and sexual freedom?
I really had to dig deep in my personal knowledge, I have to say, but it was such an experience of immersive nostalgia. And that's one of the pieces of feedback that I'm getting from early readers again and again, was this overwhelming sense of nostalgia for their younger selves.
Okay. What do you think about revisiting, you know, the notion of nostalgia? Is everything nostalgia in every memory that we have? Do you think it's healthy to have a, you know, like a live nostalgia in our life? What's your feeling on it?
I think for myself and my peers, we're so busy with the mental load, the never-ending to-do list, that there aren't many moments of quiet reflection. There are not many moments of turning around and seeing just how far we've come from the young women and girls we were. And so this is a lovely invitation to readers to immerse themselves in those heady days of youth.
Yeah, okay, absolutely. And so you mentioned it, there's this fascinating contrast between Liv's younger self and her life as a wife and mother. Why were you interested in exploring this tension between the woman we become and the girl we once were?
It was such a fun contrast to write, and I've recently started doing author events, and when I talk about this being an exploration of the post-millennium underground rave scene, I have had several women, lovely, middle-aged ladies, highly respectable looking, and they come up to me and they lean in and they say, I was a raver too. And I love this so much because we are hiding in plain sight, these wild girls that we once were. And most of us are perimenopausal now and we're losing visibility by the second, but within us beats the wild heart of a raver and no one can ever take that away from us.
I'm hearing you. I was there too. So the novel is partly about roads not taken as well. Do you think we ever really stop wondering about the lives we might have lived?
I think we all do it, and I think that's one of the things that makes this book really relatable. Whether you've lived this life or not, there's a lot of relatable themes that we all have certain sliding doors moments where we made one decision, but we always wonder about the other path we might have taken. And I think that that's something that we can all relate to. And it makes us reflective to think about those moments and wonder what our lives may have looked like had we gone in that other direction. And that's the idea seed that started this whole book. I asked myself the question, what would life look like if you had pushed away your soulmate?
That's right, yes. So, I mean, that's a fascinating subject for a novel. And so why did you begin with kind of, I guess we can say it, can't we, that Drew dies?
It's not a spoiler.
That's right.
I apologise to everyone who fell deeply in love with Drew.
Mm.
I did kill him off, and I can only offer my profound regret and condolences to everyone who's experiencing fictional grief.
Yeah,
but he had to go because that became the catalyst for the story. So to give you a little bit of context, when Olivia's first love dies unexpectedly, she has nowhere to pour her grief. She writes it into a secret confession to his Facebook Messenger. And the next day she receives a reply from someone who has their intimate photos taken a lifetime ago with an anonymous threat of exposure. So that's why he had to go, because he had promised to guard those intimate images with his life.
Mm. So the intimate photographs become a weapon against Liv. So what drew you to this sort of sextortion idea?
So many things. So I chose the past timeline to be 20 years ago because it was really the advent of digital imagery and also social media. And we didn't have the language and awareness that we have now. So I'm a mother, I'm 46 years old, I have primary school age children, and I'm already beginning to teach my children about the indelible mark of digital images. And I'm gently coaching them that any image they take, they should be comfortable with everybody that they know seeing that image, including their grandparents and teachers. Now, with the advent of this technology in the early 2000s, we had no awareness that these images that we were taking would last a lifetime, could be infinitely shareable, and could fall into the wrong hands. And so I wanted to explore what might happen in a loving relationship where they've got this burgeoning sexuality, they're exploring things, and it's from a place of love and mutual consent. And the villain here is the person who has happened upon these images and is threatening to expose them. But the interesting thing about our society is that if those images got out, it's Olivia herself who would be run through the mill. And all you have to do is look at any news headlines. We've had a lot of really very serious sexual assault cases, yeah, and men's violence against women, and you only have to look at a sample of the headlines to understand that it is women who are blamed.
Mm.
And in this situation where we have someone who is committing a crime by threatening to share these images, it would not be them who would be ridiculed and publicly scrutinised.
Absolutely. This is so topical and so important to really scrutinise our culture in this way. You know, the misogyny, but also the way technology works in that, you know, with the misogyny.
And I think we're very uncomfortable with women who will own, who are sexually empowered, who will own their sexuality and will go seeking these experiences. We're really uncomfortable with that.
Mm, that's right. So there's a very strong question about who gets judged for sexual behaviour in this novel as well, isn't there?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, why do you think we're still being judged so harshly?
Because we're women and everything is our fault. And it's impossible. We have these, yes, you know, that wonderful monologue in the Barbie movie.
Oh, yeah.
It's just impossible. The standards are impossible. Yeah. We have to, yeah, be pretty but not too pretty. We need to be sexy but we don't want to be too sexually empowered.
Mm.
These unattainable standards that are designed to bamboozle and keep us small.
Mm, mm. The patriarchy is internalized by all of us.
It is. And yeah, I'm really excited to read Chris's anthology.
Same.
Because just those few minutes of exploration and explanation, what a refreshing thing to have a man talking about these issues that run through our veins as women.
I was just thinking that and thinking how great that you have young children that you can pass this stuff on, because it's quite often so invisible, conveniently or inconveniently, for men to, you know, they have too much to lose to really see it. So thank you. I'd like us to go back to your prose, if we may, Anne, and would you mind just reading a little bit of chapter two, just so we get a sense of the world and, you know, that sort of the rave scene that you were talking about before?
I certainly can. 20 years ago, bass thrummed through the old warehouse like a heartbeat in a chest. Droplets of condensation dripped from the ceiling onto the swamp of writhing bodies below. Liv cradled her water bottle like a baby, dancing so lightly on the tips of her toes that she believed she'd left the floor. On stage, the DJ appeared in silhouette amid plumes of smoke, beating at the thick air with his fist, imploring the ravers to raise the roof.
Thank you so much. It's such an exciting read. So, did writing this novel change the way you think about your younger self?
I think that there needs to be a measure of acceptance, of compassion for our younger selves. We, each of us, are like Russian nesting dolls. There's all these versions of us lying just beneath the surface.
Oh.
And I think as I get older, I'm less inclined to judge and more inclined to look back at my younger self, perhaps with maternal kindness. We all were doing the best we can. We might not make the same choices, but it becomes the sum of who we are as well.
Mm. Oh, such wise words. Thank you. I love your imagery there as well. So, Anne, the time after now, it centres on memory, invisible disability, which we haven't even embarked on, but I believe it's a lived world experience of the invisible disability. How much did that feed into this book as well?
So I have been living with type 1 diabetes for 24 years, and this is an Own Voices portrayal of what life is like. I think that Own Voices storytelling is hugely important. There's not a lot of representation. I don't see people like myself on the page all that often. And when it is there, if it's not Own Voices, and this goes for any area, any minority area, if we don't have lived experience, those portrayals are reliant on cliches and stereotypes, and they can often do more harm than good. And so what I wanted to achieve with this book was having the reader just walk a few days, a few pages in my shoes. Now, I need 5 injections a day to live. I have countless considerations thinking about how to keep myself alive because my body is missing essential componentry for survival. My pancreas does not work. It is purely decorative. And I have to manually perform the function of my pancreas.
It's a beautiful pancreas, by the way.
I mean, it's delightful and lucky because, you know, we keep her around. But she doesn't do a lot.
Yeah.
And I take umbrage. But I'm performing manual life support. And I'm doing all of that while conducting my everyday life, while holding down jobs. I have a marriage, I have children, I have a community, I have friends. I have a radio interview right now that I'm hoping I can make it through.
Yeah.
And I just wanted readers to get a glimpse into that world because when we experience other people's lives, it's a massive opportunity for empathy. And I think that's why we read.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed the detail of that, of explaining that disability in really clear terms because I'd never really known much about it, but I found that really informative and engrossing. And at times I was really right on the edge of my seat wondering what the character is going to be able to do and how they will survive. So, with all that in mind, I'd like to remind you of the title. It's called The Time After Now by the lovely Anne Freeman, and it's published by Hawkeye.
And I've been talking with Chris Ames. I made this just for you, a short story anthology.